and I want to introduce Dana Gourier.
Thank you so much.
Well, great. I want to welcome you to upcoming discs, and that's Minnie Mink from Hateful Eight. What a incredible movie that was, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty extraordinary. Did you like it?
Yes, I did. I liked it very much. So how did you find yourself to Minnie Mink? What about that character attracted you to do this?
I don't know that it was necessarily about the character initially. It was just the fact that Quentin Tarantino called me up and said he wrote a part for me in this film. I mean, you tend to do backflips about something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And I hadn't even read one word of the script at that point. And I wish you could sign me up. I'm on board. I can't even wait to send me the script. So he did, and when I read the script, I was blown away. It was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I read Minnie's character, I kind of fell in love with her. She's so sweet, but she's also at the same time, like, you know, kind of a hard ass. She can anything from anyone.
Right.
And also, what also attracted me, too, was, you know, how different she was. She is a woman of color during a time, which was 6 to 12 years post-slavery.
Right.
And she owned her own property, and she was a proprietor of her own land and business.
Yeah.
And she ran it well.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, tell me about this haberdashery. I mean, how does it get its name? I mean, there's a lot of history we get a sense of here that we never quite get to see in the film. Can you fill us in on any of that backstory?
Sure. As it relates to the flashback, of course. So the story is that Minnie and Sweet Dave were either on the same plantation or knew each other from being near.
Right.
And Sweet Dave had a huge thing for Minnie when she was given her freedom. He didn't want to separate from her, so he offered her, to buy her own property and help her get a business started, and if she would just stay with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. They went north. And the characters in the haberdashery are sort of passers-by that ended up developing a relationship with Minnie that Minnie would ultimately hire as her worker.
Sure.
Two of them, Gemma and Charlie, mm-hmm. I believe, were not necessarily runaways. And this is my own personal, like, sort of subtext or backstory.
Right.
But they were, you know, free people of color that needed work.
Uh-huh.
So Minnie helped them out and welcomed them to her place. And then Sixth Force Judy and Ed developed a relationship with Minnie from running the line.
Right.
The Stagecoach line.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the backstory of the flashback. As it relates to Major Marquis, they had a very close relationship. I believe Minnie and the Major were real close.
Right.
Because I believe the Major had run that line many times and had stopped over in Minnie many times from being a bounty hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And so he developed a rapport. He knew her very well, and that was evident in all the chapters leading up to the flashback.
Certainly.
Because it was the things that were missing about Minnie and her haberdashery that made him so suck. The little idiosyncrasy, like, why are all these hats on?
Right.
And why does the suit taste the same, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
Which sort of lends itself to the whole whodunit.
Well, and she had her rules that he pointed out that kind of were the giveaway to him, that he knew that Minnie had these rules that weren't now being followed.
Absolutely. There were boundaries that she set in her place, which also lends to the idea that she was not playing with you. You would get put out of her place if you didn't follow the rules. And so much to the point where this man remembered the rules. How do you not know this? Nobody should have any talks on, you know, et cetera.
Right.
So, yeah, I think As brief as the moment is in that flashback and in that particular chapter,
right. The
importance is astounding. Saying earlier in an earlier interview, I do sticky tabs and dissect my script, and I can't tell you, I color coordinate them too, so every time I heard Minnie's name or any time she was mentioned or her haberdashery, I put like a little blue sticky tab. And I'm telling you, my script was riddled with blue, you know?
Right.
Man, they're talking about this woman and this haberdashery so much. Like,
right.
I can't wait till we get there. I can't wait till we meet her and I'm playing her.
Sure. And of course, the thing about Tarantino is wonderful at taking characters, putting them on screen for a very short time, but making them incredibly dynamic characters and make them such an important part of the story. And I got to believe that's one of the reasons you wanted to work with Tarantino, because this was a small part, but it's such an important, as you said, part, and it becomes such an iconic character.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. And it's what you make it too. Like,
right.
When I played Cora in Django Unchained, Cora was about 4 weeks of work and a couple of lines. And I was just so satisfied. I thought I won just having the 45-minute audition. I wasn't worried. Like, if I didn't put the part, I was like, shoot, I just got a lesson from Tarantino and hung out with him for 45 minutes.
Right.
And we had fun. Like, I'm good. Life is good. Mm-hmm. And then 2 weeks later, when I found out I booked the part, I literally almost fainted. It was crazy. Because that was my first big budgeted project that I'd ever done.
Right.
And being on set was harrowing. It was very scary because it was so green at the time.
Mm-hmm.
However, the amount of what I learned and the sort of like openness to try and play and do and be unapologetic in it,
sure.
That's to be respectful of the writer, director at the same time too, and just learned magnificent lessons.
The Haberdashery is such a wonderful set. I mean, this is a huge scope movie, but when you think about it, it all takes place both in the flashbacks and in the main part of the film. It all takes place in this one room. And
yeah.
It seems like there's a lot of detail there. Did that help with the acting? I mean, what was it really like in that set of the Haberdashery?
Let me tell you. So, our production designer's name is Yohai Kanata.
Yeah.
And he is just a genius. And that's just the thing, like, you know, earlier today in a few of these other interviews, I was talking about the trickle-down effect of who is at the helm of the ship.
Right.
The leader dictates the sort of culture of the set, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That applies to also every department head.
Yeah.
Everyone that's part of the project is just the best at what they do. From the UPM to our producers to our EP to our crafters to everybody involved.
Right.
Everybody's really, really extraordinary, and they're excited to work with Quentin. But Yohai and his team, our art directors, Benjamin Ellsberg, Richard Johnson, like, our set decorators, like, everyone, our costume designer, Courtney Kaufman and her team, the intricacy, the detail, the amount of detail that was put into the process is just incredible. I'll never forget when I got and I fell into Telluride, and getting a Telluride is not in sight. Some kind of way your luggage is going to get lost. It's just a normal thing that you have to expect. You get your items the next day.
Right.
You usually have to connect in Montrose or somewhere else because it's way high up on the mountain.
So right.
After a week of, you know, trying to get acclimated to the climate, et cetera, I asked if I could go up to set for a visit.
Yeah.
And Quentin, we had to get everything okay. And of course, they were like, sure, let her come see this place of business. And I'll never forget the ride up to Minnie on the mountain.
Right.
It was just breathtaking. And the amount of work it took to get there was extraordinary. And then when I sat foot in there, I caught my breath and I just literally started crying. I didn't mean to. It wasn't like an intentional thing. But it caught my breath so much, like the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went around. It was so funny. There's a gentleman by the name of Dan who I just made so mad, but there was a lot of love there. So
right.
He wasn't too mad, but I went around touching everything. And he just followed me around, placing everything back exactly where it was.
Yeah.
You know, and it's continuity. You can't go, like, taking candlesticks and moving them around and stuff. But I just wanted to touch everything, and there was, like, real world sleep. It was just, it was just real. Everything was authentic.
Minnie's the one who put it all there.
Yes. And I wanted to touch everything. I wanted to see why she put these furs right here.
Right.
And why are these chains hanging there that you see Kurt Ruff, Gunn go through when he's making his way over to Joe Gage, the cow puncher.
Right.
You know, I sat in Joe Gage's seat. I sat in every seat in that business center, she would have. You know, I lived in that kitchen. There's a moment where she's making coffee. You never see this on camera, but every take I would grind the coffee beans. So I wanted to feel like what this time felt like. I wanted it to get in my body. You know, I played the piano that you see Demi and Bashir's character play.
Wow.
You know, I did everything. Anything and around that, any and everything in and around that space I used, I touched, I moved around with.
So you lived Minnie.
Yeah, I did. I did. And that was just like, you know, a week before I even started shooting. But once I was shooting, like, I was always drifting around the set, just staying in as much as I possibly could, you know, just touching things and just being present and staying in.
Yeah. Well, it's a huge film. Of course, it's coming out on Blu-ray now, and so a lot more people are going to get to see it who maybe didn't see it in the theaters. So what's next for you? You've got to have some big things coming up.
Well, in theaters now is a film called Midnight Special.
Right.
It's written and directed by Jeff Nichols, and also on HBO right now is a series called The Revenant with Mark and J.B. Clark.
Mm-hmm.
The Blue Clock Brothers. They're fantastic guys. So, and I have some other projects that are being released, and right now I'm working on a really strong pilot season. Doing my thing. I'll never forget Kurt Russell said in the green room when we did the LACMA project. We did the stage reading through LACMA with Elvis Mitchell. He was telling us a story about his dad, and he was talking to us about sort of feast or famine nature of what we do and how he grew up in a blue-collar actor's house.
Right.
Some Christmases would be unbelievable. Everybody got new bikes. And mm-hmm. Other Christmases would be a little, you know, not so great.
Right.
And that was the nature of being the son of a blue-collar actor. And so ever since I heard that story, I think of myself as on that level right now.
Mm-hmm.
I consider myself a blue-collar actor. I still hustle every day. I have an audition in about an hour and a half.
Okay.
So I'm still fighting with this fight. And until I'm at the level where I feel comfortable, I think even then I'll still be fighting the good fight. You know, I'll never forget Sam said to me, because I was like, Sam, I don't want this to end. I got so sad after Jacob.
Yeah.
And he was just like, what do you mean? And I was just like, I'm scared I'm never going to work again on a project like
right.
this.
Well, but I think that you've got a great future and you've got a great outlook on this thing and a lot of energy, and Minnie's a memorable character, and I want to thank you for taking the time to share some of that with us, because it's some phenomenal stuff, and it's going to live on in that film forever.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks so much for your time, Gino.
You too. Thank you for your time. You take care and have a great one.
You too.
Okay, bye.